The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
Today on The Cyber Show, Sin cops out and stops looking for leather work. Peter rushes into a meeting and comes out a mortician. Kevin names more names and goes global. Win goes anti-viral. Ira claims you can stop stupid system designers. And lots more.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
All.net's February monthly members forum will be on Valentine's Day, Tuesday, the 14th of February. If you love, you gotta come.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. According to the Break Report, the 2023 Equinox provides an outstanding braking system. The power-assisted braking system features anti-lock braking along with 11.8-inch rotors on the front and 11.30-inch rotors on the rear. You can't get breaking news like this on any other radio show.
This is a segment we call Sin in America.
Okay, so you get out of library school and you specialized in internet and ultimately in records management. So then what happens?
I got into the library world, and the first thing that they started doing is say, you're the youngest person, you know the internet, start building us internet programs in the library. And I immediately started writing grants to get money to get computers. Back then, a Gateway 386 would have cost you $3,600. A projector was, I mean, you literally had to go and get like a scholarship just to get one of those. But I did, and we got it all because writing grants is all about talking about your population, which is all about the very young and the very old. So negotiations were early in my career. The networks, though, that we were putting in, it was the first computer network in Northern New Jersey for the public. We had the first website at the Teaneck Public Library built. It could have been in all of New Jersey, but I'll say for Northern New Jersey. And I'm 20 nothing years old. I got a lot of attention very quickly. The cops in the neighborhood started coming in and asking me, what is the internet? And I started working, teaching them, like, this is the World Wide Web. You got three websites, thewhitehouse.gov, thewhitehouse.com, which is still a pornography site.
That's a porn site, right?
Yeah.
And when I was at Sandia National Laboratories, you know, that you could get in huge trouble for going to a porn site. And so one of the secretaries trying to get to the White House accidentally went to thewhitehouse.com instead of whitehouse.gov, was just like, oh my God, reported herself. And she was like afraid she was going to get fired or arrested or something. You know,
it's just shocking.
Oh no.
Well, you know, it certainly happens. I mean, I had one, used to teach classes to the public on the internet, and I'd have these like nice little old ladies and little old men come into my library, and I would try to get them interested in, like, what are you into? What's your hobby? And, you know, Mrs. McGillicuddy liked to read. Okay, we're going to take you to websites that have books. And, you know, Jones liked to do woodworking. And then the one guy goes, well, I like leather work. And I'm like, nope, we're not doing that.
Because if you look it up in those days, what you would get is, you know.
Oh, you get leather work. Yeah.
Fair enough. All right, so you're teaching people, including the cops, about this, where does that lead you to?
Well, it moved real quickly. Now he's the chief information security officer for New Jersey, but Mike Garrity was one of the first troopers in New Jersey to do cybercrime, and I connected with him because he was testifying with Kevin Manson at Congress about the dangers of the internet. And you know, me doing my research, which I'm really good at, I sought him out. I asked him for help because my local police department wanted to put a computer in their building and they needed testimonials. So I just was reaching out to everybody. I reached out to you. I reached out to Dr. Bill Tafoya, you know, like all five of you that were actually looking at cybercrime back in the day. You know, a lot of folks in California, the usual suspects, we call them. And I found this real wonderful cadre of professionals who, instead of saying, you don't belong here, you're a librarian, you're a girl, whatever, I was embraced by the community and like dragged in, like, well, you're a librarian, we could use you. And I came willingly. I say every day I'm here.
I'll tell you something else. You're a good-looking female. We can use you in undercover work.
Yeah. Well,
that's really the, you know, because it's really hard in that environment because at that time, you know, and look, this is still true to do today, mm-hmm. right? There's enormous discrimination against women in cyber everything. And it's incredibly offensive and stupid, right? But nevertheless, it exists. But those, even in that time frame, who embraced, you know, the women in the field were more successful because, yeah. Let's see, you know, you're smart, you're effective at what you do, you're good at influence operations. Mm-hmm. But all right, so let's get to that part of it in the next segment here. So.
And now a word from our sponsor. Our next Angel to Exit monthly advisory meeting will be February 14th, Valentine's Day, at 9 a.m. Pacific. Our next All.net members forum will be at 11 o'clock that same day. To attend, sign up to our mailing list through thecybershow.co.
To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up. During this segment of the show, we talk to historical figures from the cyber world. We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Peter Neumann. His long career exemplifies a great deal of the time and effort and expertise involved in the development of the cyber world that we live in today. So, Peter, welcome back.
Yeah.
So at some point, you started to get into multics and cybersecurity. And the part of the problem is I think we could have a great discussion for the next week talking about all these different machines and the mechanisms, you know, because I spent, you know, the beginning of my career was in electrical engineering and digital systems and all of the things involved, coding and such.
Yeah.
I ended up working for Edelman. You know, yeah. I was a graduate student of Edelman, so he certainly pushed some of that into my brain along with, you know, the other guys that were on my committee, you know, Reed and Solomon.
Yeah. So let me get back to Bell Labs then. On January 2nd in 1965, I was walking in from the parking lot, and I happened to be walking parallel to Victor Vysotsky, a Russian origin. There's another famous Russian singer with the same name, but Vic was a software guy. He was an operating system guy. He was part of the BSIS effort. And I said, where are you going? He said, well, I'm rushing in for a meeting. It starts at 9 o'clock. Maybe you want to come along.
Sure, why not?
And I said, absolutely. I've been kicking around all this coding stuff, information coding, not programming stuff for 5 years. And it's time for me to do something different. He said, well, you're going to love this. We've got brand new hardware that's coming in. It's got segmentation and paging and a whole bunch of stuff, the page tables and some stuff that nobody's ever seen before. And the hardware's already been designed by Ted Glaser and John Kalur at GE. Ted was a guy who was legally blind in one eye at 6 and at the other eye at 12. He had the most vision of anybody I've ever known in my life, in the broader sense.
Yeah.
So we walked in, and there was a meeting, and it was the first meeting of what became Multics. And the Bell Labs stuff was something that Dick was responsible for. And we were going to work with MIT and GE. And so we came up with a lot of stuff that was very preliminary.
Yeah, my impression is you can still run, you know, the multicians are obviously still out there, and you can still run multics in a simulator today, right?
Yeah, you can actually get the source code. It's now Honeywell took over from GE, and the source code is available, and there are emulators available. And simulators and all kinds of things, and you can actually run the code. So I don't know what happened was on Memorial Day, we started in a AT&T training center in Hopewell, New Jersey. This was the first meeting of all of the MIT people, the GE people. The head of the GE group was a guy named Helmut Sassenfeld, and he was the guy who brought to life the meaning of the GE expression, progress is our most important product. His motto was, progress reports are our most important product.
And
he wanted monthly reports of how everything was coming in the architecture. And what happened in that meeting is we agreed to write 5 papers, which would be presented in the Fall Joint Computer Conference in Las Vegas in November. Vic and Barbato got to write a paper. Ed David, who was our vice president, and Bob Fano at MIT of Fano Coding.
That was a time when you didn't have a difficulty getting a paper into the conference. I mean, you weren't submitting competitively, right?
Yeah. And then Bob Daly and I wrote the file system design, and that was great. We had a wonderful time doing that. And that was the conference at which Sutherland showed up. Ivan showed up with his paper on the sketchpad. And he had a paper in which, when he saw the galleys, they didn't show him the drawings, but they were his drawings. They were his computer-generated drawings. And this is the first attempt to have reproducible artwork.
Yeah.
With the detailed drawings drawn by computer. When he got to the conference and he saw the proceedings.
Oh, what is it? A human being had redone them?
Yeah, the editor had said, these are not up to the standards. These are not up to the standards of the publisher. So he's professionally redrawn all of your drawings.
Yeah, which was the whole point was no.
No. The whole purpose was to show that you could draw things with computers. So that was a wonderful thing. But we had the 5 papers, and that was the real beginning of the work to produce the software.
Okay, how the world has changed. So first off, you have, here are my plates produced by the computer to show what the computer can produce. And they say, not good enough, we're going to redraw them. So you don't actually get the scientific output.
Yeah, the law of unintended consequences there. Somebody was trying to do something, to help out, but they actually had the opposite effect.
I don't know if you had this experience, but when I was writing my dissertation, I had a phrase talking about computer viruses and the problem of undecidability that said, there ain't a horse that can't be rode, ain't a man that can't be throwed. It's quoted in my dissertation. And it got to the review process, and they said, you can't have it in here. It's improper English. And I'm like, no, it's a cowboy saying that applies. Yeah. Finally, that argument went back and forth. They said, okay, then I need the reference. Well, it's a popular saying. There is no reference for it. So we had to create a phony citation to a non-existent thing so we could then have, it's like, hello, do you not understand, Oops, sorry, even in a quote, you can't misspell things. Well, but that's how it was spelled. All right, so there's that whole facet of the thing, which I find ridiculous and bizarre. But then there's this other thing where in those days, you could say to the program manager, sure, I'll write a report that's in the National Computer Conference. No problem. Anybody that's in one of those research groups is going to get a paper into that conference. You want 5 of them? Sure, we'll write 5 for you. Anything you write is going to be acceptable. Anything you write is going to be sufficiently novel. There's not going to be a peer review process. There's a whole funding process associated with that. And all of that has changed dramatically since the early days. And I would love to see the formation of a community that's not that way, where we get new ideas, novel areas, funding based on good people getting funded to do interesting things, and the conference that says, the funded people doing interesting things will be able to present their papers. But the world is not that way because publisher perish, and the credentialing system and the peer review process and all this stuff. You're in academia. By the way, you're also a researcher, but you must have thoughts and reflections on how this all works.
Reflecting on this, my dissertation work was in looking at, not to get technical, looking at for inconsistencies amongst security policies for systems. And so I applied theorem proving and other techniques to work through that. But I actually had some very good ideas, and those ideas were eventually commercialized and got into the mainstream. But you know, typically, if you're at the forefront and you're doing things that other people aren't doing, you're not part of the clique. You're not, your work doesn't even fit into a conference or symposium that the technical community has formed for discussing interesting things. You have to sort of wedge yourself in. So from an academic standpoint, it's sometimes really hard to get those new ideas that might spur along actual innovation, changing workflow processes, changing ways that we can discover new ways of doing business. It's really hard. And that's one of the interesting things that Peter brought up about Multics. Multics at the time, I mean, that was a major change in paradigm, making computing systems shareable. I mean, Multics is was the first, as far as I know, the time-sharing operating system for having multiple users use the same computer. I mean, it was a really major change in the way we think. You mentioned that as well. And then we also have been kind of hindered by this idea of working at the extremes of spectrums. You mentioned the fact that early computer graphics weren't all that good. People wanted, you know, to add the art piece to it and, you know, refine it so that the drawings were really good looking to the human eye. But we've also seen people do things on the other extreme in computing where they've tried to make the audio and video quality so good, but beyond what even a human can sense with our own sensory organs, because we work within ranges. And so we need to get back to the basics, or I think many, and at least in industry, there's that idea that you actually engineer systems. You build them good enough for the purpose that they were made for, whether it's a multi-user operating system or computer graphics or computer gaming. You have finite resources to construct these applications and systems. So engineering, I think, is really key to innovation, because you're actually making engineering trade-offs amongst these different properties and functions and things that you would like to have in the system or application.
I want to just bring up deep fakes and the difference between what you can do and what you should do. The question is, other than, you know, malicious influence operations where you're basically doing frauds and lies, but other than those malicious purposes, and I'll call them malicious, there's no rational reason to make a fake sufficiently good to truly fool somebody looking at a forensic level. Just no reason. You can make a movie that's so high quality, no human being can tell the difference between whether Barack Obama said something or Ronald Reagan said it. And you can make the movie and it could all have all those appearances without going to the extreme of being difficult or almost impossible to detect by forensics. And now we have, in the digital forensics arena, anti-forensic methods. And the anti-forensic methods have always been used by criminals, but now so-called legitimate researchers are saying, well, we can come up with a new anti-forensic techniques. So they're actually intentionally getting funded to cause things to be difficult to detect from a forensic standpoint. And of course, you know, the bad guys, you know, learn from this and take advantage of it. So instead of letting the bad guys do what they will and having, you know, the sensible part of society fight against it, we've decided to fight against ourselves. And it's the same with, you know, new techniques to break into computers. It's not a benefit for us to write more and more attack code to break into more and more computers. It's not a benefit to society, but we reward people who do it. And we call them security researchers when all they're doing is finding another vulnerability in some piece of code that we already knew why it could happen and that it could happen and how it could happen. And people made a mistake. And so somebody figured out how to exploit that mistake, and they're getting paid to figure out how to exploit other people's mistakes. If we did that in any other field of endeavor, we would have bridges falling down, windows breaking, and everything else. And we would never be able to have a society that worked.
Right. Well, I think there are legitimate reasons for finding those vulnerabilities, and actually reverse engineering is one of my specialties. Or so, for example, let's take a camera system. Like, you have a point and shoot camera, and it has what we call a image pipeline, in which the image that the sensor in the camera takes is then processed into something that the actual user of the camera would like to display for themselves or for others. And so I've looked at ways of breaking that image pipeline and breaking it when there are actually anti-reversing and anti-forensics techniques applied. And one of the reasons for doing that is to be able to, for legitimate reasons like protection of intellectual property, looking for things like patent infringement, algorithms that are used in the information pipeline for processing that image data from an analog form that's captured by the sensor, and then the digital form that's actually stored on in the camera's memory and then transferred to usually a computer. We're talking about digital cameras here. So I think there are reasons. There are also reasons for national security, such as supply chain risk management. We want to know that a particular piece of hardware or the software running in that hardware is actually a legitimate non-counterfeit component, especially for things that go into, like, let's say a train control system or your Tesla vehicle or anything else that these days that has computer controls or is used.
So I agree with that. But my question is, how is getting better at breaking into those things help in designing them so that we can determine that they're legitimate?
Well, we actually see malfeasance or at least malpractice during a community where it may not be the engineer's intention. It may be a company or whoever funds the...
What you're talking about is people that are not doing their job well in creating the things.
Right.
But the solution to that is not breaking into them. The solution to that is assuring that they do the job right. And the idea that the way I'm going to prove that you're doing the right job of making a baseball bat is to try and break every baseball bat, I think it's the wrong approach, right? We should devise an engineering capability to allow us to figure out how to do it right and do it right without breaking it. You can inspect something to determine that it's not modified without breaking it. And I don't have to know how to break it to determine that it's right. And spending all those resources on finding more ways to break it provides many more capabilities to break it that are readily reproducible by attackers and very difficult to defend against. And if we pursue that line, every window is going to have to be bulletproof, and we're going to keep building bigger bullets. And at what point do we say, no, we're going to stop building bigger weapons to break glass, and we're going to stop trying to make our glass bulletproof? Instead, we're going to say, as a society, if you build bigger bullets to break glass, you're going to go to jail. And we can just use a window that's good enough against the wind and the rain that doesn't have to be bulletproof in order to have a house.
Yes, but I would say that it's a matter of trust. And we've had this conversation, the two of us have had this conversation before. And, you know, like you said, trust is basically how much you are willing to let somebody else do harm to you, possibly. And it's really hard to trust most modern products, especially those that are termed part of the Internet of Things, because you don't know anything about their provenance. You don't know what might be hidden in them. They may behave fine for a long time, and then they have a logic bomb in them, or they have a vulnerability that somebody else will exploit.
Yeah, all that's true, but why is it that instead of figuring out how to build them more worthy of trust and how to test them to determine that they're trusted, instead we focus on trying to break into them?
Actually, I'm one of the people in the former category that actually have been working in the area of what we call formal methods or mathematical modeling and reasoning about hardware and software systems. And of course, the mixed signal systems, the analog and digital world. So yeah, I think that is the way to go. Been exploring that for cyber physical systems, looking at can we work just at the interface? Because it's very hard to mathematically model correctly or at high enough fidelity the physical side of cyber physical systems, which are pretty much every system. Even my cell phone is a cyber physical system.
Oh, yeah. Cybernetic. The term cybernetic is actuator, sensors, communications, and control, as defined in the book called Cybernetics.
And you have the software that is quite complex as well. And it's hard to model that, but you know, I've been looking at ways to do the formal verification and validation of these systems and not have to go down the route of trying to always break them.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story. We're talking to Kevin, who is the originator of the term Cyber Cops and who has trained more Cyber Cops probably than anybody else in the world.
After you finished the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, and I guess retired for the first or however many times, at that point, you started to work in private industry and the Cyber Cop portal became, how big did the Cyber Cop portal ultimately become? How many cyber cops from around the world ended up on it?
We had as many as, I think, 14,000 at one point. And the Department of Homeland Security was so proud of us that they were congratulating us for putting this thing up. And they didn't provide a nickel of financial support for the portal. We ran that portal for 17, 18 years successfully. And I say we because it took a lot of other people to help moderate and bring new members on board, and especially the people that ran the hardware and the servers. I mentioned Bob Dolly. He was one of the reasons why that came to be. Another fellow named Matt Donlan. I don't mind mentioning names. George Johnson. These are people that you are aware of yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. So, all right. So your career sort of never really ended because you're still, I think, involved in it to some extent, right? You ended up working to help develop programs around the world. I know you worked with Tom Johnson on developing, you know, some of his programs, and you've been involved with universities after that. So at this point, you're, I guess, officially retired. Is that right? Or are you still doing Cyber Cop stuff?
Well, pretty much. I was fortunate to be able to teach at the University of New Haven, thanks to Tom Johnson and Bill Tafoy. Also, at my alma mater undergraduate, University of Washington, the iSchool, thanks to Barbara Popowski, very thankful. And then also was very fortunate back in 2001 to be invited through a friend that I met at DEF CON. I was invited over to Germany at the NATO school in Oberammergau in Bavaria. And I met this wonderful gentleman, Volker Kozak, colonel. And he had a wonderful conference that I've been to half a dozen times. Called Bulletproof Hosting. So I've made several trips to that, and I've been very thankful that I've been able to also have my wife with me for three of those trips to Europe.
Yeah, and Volker is still, I guess, running those programs, or is he done running the programs? Because they used to travel around the world, you know, meeting with folks at military bases and so forth. I know they came with, met with us, and I've been to some of their other meetings, right?
Yeah, and he's retired, I guess, from the Bundeswehr, you know, officially, but he still owns that segment, the Bulletproof Hosting thing, and he's made his own. He has his own group. I call mine the Usual Suspects. He calls his the Unusual Suspects.
There you go. Kevin Manson, if you're a cyber cop, you've probably been trained by him, unless you're a very recent cyber cop, right? And if you haven't been trained by him, you've probably been trained by somebody that was trained by him, right?
You know, Fred, I'm glad you mentioned that. Just a real brief thing here. We trained over 80 different agencies at Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. And people wonder why so many, because any agency that had a person who was authorized to conduct an arrest or a weapon or conduct an investigation, they all had to be trained at FLETC. And that includes, NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences. And one of their people was doing undercover investigations years ago. His name is Noel Tognazinek. I still remember his name. He was doing investigations on the illegal trade of narwhal tusks. Okay. And then I'd go to a national park somewhere and I'd see a ranger with a sidearm on him, and that meant they had to train at FLETC. I'd walk up to them and I'd say, how did you do on your legal exams at FLETC? And they'd kick it back I said, yeah, you've probably been in some of my classes. So it's been a great ride, Fred. I'm tapering up, and what I'm tapering into, one of my great passions is rescue transports.
Rescue transports. There you go. Outstanding. A lifetime of service. It's a wonderful life.
And I've partnered with you for 50 of those years, my wife. Yeah.
You've traveled the world. You've seen the evolution of cyber policing from before there was such a thing through basically the most modern versions of it. You've worked for local, state, federal, global institutions and organizations doing this. But give me just a quick number. What's the total number of cyber cops you think have been through any of your programs?
Wow. It's easier, Fred, to tell you the numbers that I trained at PLETSI through both the cyber training and the other training. But our classes were typically 50, and I would train 50 at a time, and I'd have as many as 4 or 5 of those classes every week. And so I think the closest estimate I can come up with is at the Federal Enforcement Training Center during my 20-year career there, I trained probably close to 100,000 federal, state, local, tribal agents.
All right, so that's the first 100,000, right? And more beyond that, right?
Well, that's the beauty of this. You know, I've been fortunate to meet some folks who carried that torch and are doing better work than I could have ever done. One comes to mind, Craig Bowling, and you know Craig.
Yeah, sure.
100,000 plus. You know, that was just in PLETSI. That's 20 years of a 50-year career. And of course, they've then gone on to train everybody else. So his effect on the world is just astonishing. When you just look at the numbers of people in law enforcement that he's taught about cyber, you know, policing.
You know, and he said, you know, what a ride it has been. I can't agree more, right? You know, I'm a high school dropout. I don't really know how I get to know Volker Kozak, who, like so many people, you know, you and I know, and, you know, Volker would be great to get on this show, right? Because you know, Volker was the Kevin in Germany, basically in the German military, who said, we should have a cyber thing. And they said, basically, okay, you build it. And he did. You know, so Volker's the guy that put together the entire German cybersecurity, you know, military, everything. Fascinating guy. Just unbelievable. And
yeah, you know that if I interviewed everybody that I've dealt with, that we would be here until, you know, 22,000. You know, there's a lot of people out there. And I'd love to interview Volker, but we have another 10 sort of in the queue just to get through the first quarter of next year. There's another thing I wanted to bring up, and you might have not caught this right early on with the CyberCop portal, but this links very closely into you because, you know, you ran the ICS ISAC, created and ran the ICS ISAC, Information Sharing and Analysis Center, which was the third largest ISAC in the country before you formed then the next one for ISALs, Information Sharing and Analysis Organizations, because they changed the initials. Talk a little bit about, you know, how that worked, because remember, the CyberCop portal was at some point 100,000 cyber cops sharing information, including at high levels of confidentiality on specific cases.
You know, I'm trying to, you know, there's two parts of this, you know, for the viewership out there, listenership, right? You know, that you know, there's the history of it, which is just a lot of fun, right? And there's lessons to take going forward, right? And I've said this before, we're not done yet with this. And you look at a lot of these things, you know, me, you, Kevin, Volker, you can go on all day long, who are individuals in the place, in the U.S. federal government, in the military, in, you know, some other country, in private sector, wherever, who said, I think we need a thing. And they put it together. And that first step wasn't rocket science, you know, and it wasn't usually right or perfect, right? But we increment our way here. And this is, you know, listen to Kevin, the usual suspects. Oh, my God, Kevin knows everybody, right? And
well, only a few 100,000 of the top people in the world in cyber, whatever, right?
Right. And, you know, each one has had a wild ride. And it's not because they went to school, you know, or they did a thing. It's because they've taken a step, moved forward. All these, you know, the 007, you know, the James Bond thing that we see in the movies really doesn't happen that way. What happens is individuals are just trying to address the thing in front of them. And there's this nearly infinite opportunity ahead of us in cybersecurity, in cyber writ large, you know, and in the world at large. You have to do things that haven't been done before.
But I want to go back to information sharing, because you were important in that space. And there are a couple of really important things. One of them, of course, is STICS and TAXI, right? These protocols for sharing cybersecurity related information. But the thing that I found much more compelling than any of that was your understanding, as you explained it to me, and I think many, many other people, that information sharing is not about releasing your secrets. if one person in 100 speaks and the other 99 listen, the sharing was incredibly valuable, right? Because it's not, you know, between two people, it seems like it's uneven. If I say something to you and you don't tell me, but in large populations, just a little bit of outbound sharing does tremendous good for the entire society.
Well, like you're saying, so in cybersecurity, threat intelligent information sharing is what the ISAC, ISO whole thing is all about, right? You know, it's a lot like any other dynamic. You know, in any room, in any, you know, working group, in any committee, in any, you know, bus stop, you know, it's not everybody speaking at once. You know, you're lucky if one person will speak up, but that's how we work with things. So you're right, with threat intelligence, you know, it's not about everybody in the world saying, hey, I've been attacked, but if some of us can do it sometimes, that really changes everything. And yeah, as I, you know, currently I'm so focused on in the supply chain world, and kind of everything is supply chain. Threat intelligence is just information about things in your supply chain in the first place. Otherwise, you wouldn't care about it. And it's just, you know, the intellectual property control, right? It freaks everybody out with threat intelligence and with supply chain, with SBOM and supply chain information. But we look at how you're controlling your IP now, right now. Two organizations, the way you control IP is you agree, you write it down, as we talk to lawyers on this show, and you have a contract in place. Now you have people, yourself or employees, who try to keep that in mind. and try not to do the things they think they're not supposed to do. You know, our IP control is not perfect by any means now, and we get through the day anyways.
There's another really interesting thread out of this, and that is, you know, the indicators of compromise that are now shared are very often these cryptographic hashes, the same concept as the cryptographic hashes associated with the pornography. The same concept is used for the IOCs, the indicators of compromise, the identification of potentially malicious software or altered software through the change in cryptographic checksums. And the whole supply chain is authenticated by the same set of technologies. And for me, this runs back to, you know, a paper I wrote in 1984, you know, the cryptographic checksums for integrity protection, that was the first attempt at trying to detect change indicative of malicious alteration associated with computer viruses. So you look at the spread of that one little chunk of technology and the effect it has across this enormous spectrum of things. And it's astonishing to me to look at the path by which it gets carried from place to place to place. You know, the law enforcement with innocent images, then moves into information sharing. And now it's an enormously widespread technique for all sorts of different things. And it's just astonishing to me the extent to which that has an effect and the positivity surrounding it.
We'll be telling more stories from CyberCops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time, KMBY, 1240 a.m. And on the web at thecybershow.co.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Our next Angel to Exit monthly advisory meeting will be February 14th, Valentine's Day, at 9 a.m. Pacific. Join the mailing list at a2e.co for details. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E.co.
Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. This is a variation on the age-old computer repair scam. The old scam is they call you up or they email you saying computer repair, and they offer assistance in repairing something that they claim is broken on your computer. In doing so, you give them access to your computer or a password or an identity or some other information that they want so that they can do the repair. And sometimes they'll do the apparent repair right in front of your eyes using a remote access to your computer and typing commands on your behalf. Basically, they've now taken over your computer. That's the classic computer repair. The new version of this is you have a bunch of messages pending.
Five messages are pending.
Or your email account is out of service.
You have some incoming messages that are placed on hold.
Or you need to reactivate your account or one of those sorts of things.
Kindly reactivate your FC at all.net account below to access incoming messages.
From your domain so that it looks like it's a message from somebody that operates the repair service within your environment. It will have a click-through that says something like
reactivate account here.
And then, of course, it'll, you know, be from
administrator team, all.net admin.
And it'll have some sort of a pseudo-copyright notice at the bottom in some cases because, you know, they should copyright it, I guess.
All rights reserved 2022.
When you look at the button, if you put your mouse over top of the button, it'll give you a URL typically in the bottom area of the screen. In this case, the URL is a whole bunch of characters, clearly not from your domain. So that's one of the ways you can figure it out.
generally speaking, any repair message, any message saying that they're going to do something to help you, if you believe it at all, the way you should check it out is to call outbound to whatever the service is where you do computer repair, not relying on anything within the message itself, and see whether they contacted you. What you'll find is they haven't in almost every case. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books.
The Cyber Show is brought to you by Silence.
We're talking to Wynn, who is perhaps the most influential person in the world when it comes to teaching children about how to be safe and ethical in the cyber world. There you go. So, all right. So now let's move along to later in your career. So now the virus thing comes out. And how did you end up with an antivirus product?
We had built a product for the DOD, the IRS. It was all government work, and it was based upon the DES chip and what was the first generation Orange Book. For anybody that remembers Orange Book,
when the Orange Book came out, you know, that's just after the computer virus publication came out that showed that you could defeat all of those systems.
We can get into all the, that would bore the hell out of this audience, because then we got to go into A, you know, B, C, D's and all that. But we had a product, and it was a network security product tied into Novell that provided, and I'm just going to say reasonable for the day, discretionary access control, user IDM, such as it existed in the day, real, real basic stuff, but it worked in a Novell environment. Because we had designed it to do that, and
was it user friendly?
None of this crap was user friendly, but it was the only thing that was user friendly is once it all got set up and the administrator worked his way through god awful screens, there was an automatic crypto between the servers and the clients. And that was the big feature. But in those days, that's when the virus mess started. We said, hey, we're going to go build an antivirus product just to be able to promote and help sell what we called CompSec 2, which was the full-blown security system that was used in government computers in the day. So we built this crappy little piece of software that was not user-friendly and got a bunch of publicity out of it just because there weren't a lot of people out there doing that at that time. And we gave it away, which annoyed other people because we were just trying to promote the other stuff. And that's when the FBI showed up for the first time in my house.
Because you were giving it away, somebody else got unhappy and reported you to the FBI as a bad guy.
You know, it's not the first time the government came after me. So it's possible, and it's a nice story to tell my grandson.
All right, well, then you got to tell us about the other times the FBI came after you or the government, but we'll talk about that another time. We're gonna take a break here. We're going to come back and talk to you some more.
Fair enough.
What do you think as a path to get into business?
Well, that's how it happens, right? You know, I love these stories. You know, I think I've shared my own on this, you know, in this forum in the show already, but, you know, there was a Chinese restaurant napkin. We were selling a lot of, equipment so people could dial into the internet and so forth, and they didn't know how anything worked. It's like, well, okay, we need to make a box, and there's all these things, and you just look at it and it's a click. It's like, well, it's got to do security, the edge box thing, right? So viruses, you know, and you and Wynn, right? You know, you wrote the PhD thesis, everybody started thinking about it and looking at it. You know, folks like Wynn, as we discuss all the time, in those days, the DOD and so forth couldn't turn to someone with a PhD in cybersecurity, didn't exist, right? You get crazy folks like us who just happen to be, the first couple laying around or in the right place at the right time to say, let's go down this path, right?
But so now for all of those of us that spend our lives thinking and working and planning and trying really hard and being systematic and all this, none of that works at all, right?
No, well, it does in its own way, right? You know, but there's, you know, you got to, you know, as we're always discussing, decide who you are, what you want as a person, as a company and so forth. You know, I live the life I do because this is the life I want to live, right? You know, you and I have,
you know, one company, I think, going at the rate at the time we started ourselves. You know, think about it. What are we trying to achieve with it? Right. And yeah, a lot of the times, you know, just running out and doing things will put you in places where you could be, you know, standing all alone by yourself in the rain. That's usually what happens. Or maybe, you know, in some place before anybody else gets there. And it becomes, you know, a fascinating spot.
All right. So now we're talking about this statistical bias, right? That we hear the stories. If every success story you hear, almost every success story you hear is going to be a story like this. And what you're not hearing is the other 1,000 failure stories that go along with it. Right.
Right. You know, I've got my whole bunch of myself, right? You know, and lots of, you know, we're talking about, you know, millions and billions of people. Right? One of the fascinating things about the world right now is there are so many people that at any one given moment, a million people at this moment are doing some esoteric little niche thing, right? That's 0.00 something or other of the population. And maybe it never becomes anything. Maybe it becomes something 100 years from now, 30 years from now, right? And you have to decide if you can't get game these things out. You know, none of us, you know, Wynn didn't get where he was because he said, you know what? What I really want to, you know, no. You know, that's not how any of this works. Not in the early days.
Luck favors the prepared, right? That's the fundamental. Yeah. And the other thing is, if you want to guarantee success, I guess you need to go statistical, right? That is to say, you need to increase your odds of success by doing lots and lots of different things, most of which will fail. And you have to be more prepared to have better luck. And you combine that preparation with good fortune, and it happens to come together. And then you have to recognize it so you don't miss that opportunity. And then you have to move forward with it. And so as a formula for success, that's all fine and good. But we all know that that's just the reality is that luck happens. It's like an angel on your shoulder, right?
Right. You know, Wynn was lucky. You were lucky. I was lucky. Bill Gates was lucky, right? You know, most people try things, you know, aren't hitting that exact mark. Most things each of us try are not hitting that exact mark. But
what do you mean was lucky? I am lucky.
Well, I was going to say, you know, the fun thing about folks like you and Wynn and so many people we know is, you know, we're self-aware of that, right? You know, not a lot of pomposity going on. It's like, you know, this is crazy. I was doing a thing because I thought it was really cool, and I ended up here. I'm on stage, and there's a bunch of feds listening to every word I say. Or, you know, and
instead of arresting me, they offered me money.
Right. And they probably should have arrested me. I didn't say that.
Well, some of them got arrested. Yeah. So one of the things I always try to do is not undertake criminal acts. And that was my strategy for avoiding being arrested. Whereas other people, you know, just were outright criminals, right? They did things that were illegal. They knew they were illegal. They got caught. They ended up in jail. They became famous for it because, you know, the media loves a good story. But none of them that I'm aware of are doing all that well.
Sure. And who knows?
So Bill Gates admitted, you know, to these things, as did the guy that founded Apple. And many of the people that are rich and famous undertook criminal acts when they were young and got away with it. And some of them are continuing to undertake criminal acts and get away with them. But for those of us that are, you know, good people and desire to be good people and try not to do bad things to other people and try not to do criminal acts, there's hope for us too, right?
As far as we can tell so far, at least.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Our next Angel to Exit monthly advisory meeting will be February 14th, Valentine's Day, at 9 a.m. Pacific. Our next All.net members forum will be at 11 o'clock that same day. To attend, sign up to our mailing list through thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking to Ira, who is perhaps one of the world's best-known red team leaders when it comes to the cyber arena. Well, so there's some other issues, right? There's risk aggregation. We're mm-hmm. way over-aggregating risk because we don't bother to figure it out, right? And then there's separation of duties, right, which we don't implement. You know, typically you have a network administrator who can do anything to the entire network of a major corporation, or even if the duties are somehow limited, you know, they make one mistake and all of a sudden the whole corporation's off air, you know, because it was in a BGP route or something like that, Border Gateway Protocol, for those that don't, obviously everybody should know what BGP is. Mm-hmm. So you make a mistake in BGP and you're off the air, and they don't have change control over the BGP routing, and they don't have separation of duties over the BGP routing, and there's one person that can do it. There might be 20 that can do it, but any one of them does it, you're off the air. So Facebook is down for 8 hours or however long. And it's just, you know, they just didn't bother to figure it out. Is that what you see?
Well, I have, so in my book, You Can Stop Stupid. Stupid, by the way, is not the end user. Stupid are the people who design systems that allow one person to create all this damage. Because even if somebody is completely ignorant, and people look, you know, people just look at the malice, or people look at the lack of awareness. They're not even considering the fact that somebody might intend to cause damage. In accounting, for example, they have accounting procedures in place to stop errors, but also to detect malice. There should be the same type of thing in cybersecurity, where we are the people giving users all the capability. At the same time, we're the people who allow the users to create damage. Now,
so you're talking about risk aggregation, right? So mechanisms that control it are aggregating the risk. The decision-making process is a very small number of people. They don't do the same thing there as they do for accounting. And that, so this is another one of my pet peeves, and you can tell me if you see it differently. When you talk about these thresholds for action, you know, if somebody is allowed to write a check for only up to some threshold, right? That's a limitation, and that's a dependent on their position and their level in the institution and so forth. At the same time, somebody in a computer environment can cause much more than that much damage, and there's lots of people authorized to that. They don't have the same limitations on consequences associated with acts associated with computers as they have for consequences associated with acts associated with money. Why don't they do that? Why don't they set the thresholds for consequences for actors and require the same sort of controls based on consequences?
Well, that's true to a certain extent, but at the same time, I look at it in other ways where you're looking at it's what you're saying is sandboxing. But for
I'm diagnosing a problem.
Well, so looking at this issue this way, I look at it in the first place, like, you know, one of the stereotypics is somebody clicking a phishing message. Everybody says, oh, the user just needs better awareness.
No, you can't do it in the first place.
How did that phishing message get to the user? There was a case where I remember somebody was giving away stickers at a conference that said, don't click on. And since we can't say the regular word, I'll say stuff with my Dr. Evil quotes, said, don't click on stuff. And the guy in front of me on the line was an admin. He's like, oh, I need a whole bunch of these stickers. I got a lot of users that keep clicking on stuff. I'm like, wow, you must be giving your users a lot of stuff to click on. And then he was like, what do you mean?
Why did you let them do stupid things? Right?
Well, why did you give them the something stupid? Why did you hand them the ability to do something stupid? Why did you give them the harmful phishing message? The people who are blaming the user for clicking are not going back and saying, wait a second, I gave the user that crap to click on. And
there are inherent imperfections in detection, but at the same time, that doesn't excuse the fact that so much of it gets to the users that just doesn't have to.
Right. And so that's number one. But then, you know what? We don't go through and say, look, users have the following capabilities. And those
we don't limit what they do. We don't do default deny. We do default allow, right?
Yep.
But part of it is, so if you're in a bank and you're a teller in a bank, you can reasonably restrict what they do. But for the vast majority of people out there, they're working for companies. The companies don't feel they can restrict what those people can do and still get those workers to work in that environment. And the workers, you know, do not like to be restricted from doing what they want to do.
Mm-hmm. Well,
now, if you can reasonably say, hey, too bad. If you want the job, do it, right?
Well, again, it's sort of like some people don't have the support of their company, and that's a potential problem. But at the same time, what you need to start to do is say, wait a second. You know, you need to be able, I have this expression, secure, like CISOs get the budgets they deserve, not the budgets that they need. And they need to learn to deserve what they need. And that means they've got to make the case. Nobody would ever stop an accountant or a CFO from saying, look, we need all these series of controls in place. Now, they could negotiate with them, But, you know, if a CFO says, hey, I need, in order to have accurate accounting, I need these systems put in place, whether it's technical, whether it's operational processes or whatever the case is.
Right. Well, but they're also going to be required to do GAAP accounting.
Exactly. Right?
And which means in order to do GAAP accounting, I need to follow these rules. And here are the audit rules. We need to follow those rules. So there are all sorts of rules in place for accounting. And it's not as dynamic an environment typically as the, you know, Wild West computing environment we're living in, where we're going to be now communicating via Twitter instead of communicating via email, instead of using, you know, the next 50 applications that come along. So this Wild West attitude, there was a period of time when corporations were trying to stop people from doing that. And what they found is when you keep people from doing their job, they will find a way around it. So instead of having the cooperation of the people that work there, they were fighting against the users. So they've sort of given up on fighting against the users, and they've therefore lost some of the battle because they don't have the resources to compensate. What do you think of that little back and forth?
Well, I should know this term, the just society. Was that the term of art that Ira used? You know,
something like that, yeah.
Right, you know, so we're not creating that in the corporate environment yet, you know, from a cybernetic standpoint, from an information space standpoint, you know, obviously. You know, we're putting people in places where they can't necessarily get it right at every level, right? You know, CISO 5 years ago, I want to say about 5 years ago, I think personally it became a serious title. Before that, it was, you know, a fusible link for boards and a good way to, you know, to boost your career for 2 years until you did something else. So we need to keep working better to define that space.
In various online forums, I see more and more CISOs and other people responsible sort of throwing up their hands and saying, you're just asking too much. And this gets back to the scope issue, that the scope is just too broad for what they have to cover and for the authorities that they have. And organizations have to more clearly define what the duties are. This gets back to the duty to protect issue, right? You have to define the duties in order to be able to carry out those duties. And if the duties are not commensurate with the funding and the power and influence that the person has, then they can't reasonably be expected to accomplish it. And so there's just a lack of balance and understanding, I think, at the top levels of enterprises in what is actually required. And then the other thing is risk avoidance is something they just don't do. You can tell them that the consequences are so high if you take this approach, and they say, look, you're the security guy, you just take care of it. And you say, well, you don't have the budget or the capability. And they say, well, get another cybersecurity guy. Obviously, you don't know what you're doing, because I've seen advertisers that say they've solved all my problems.
Well, you know how much I love to link together the economics of security, right? You know, when the case is that you will lower your costs, be more profitable, and be more competitive by doing this thing that is also better security, everyone's going to do that. That's evolutionary. You know,
yeah, but they don't. Explaining that is hard to do.
Well, but you know, it's just not true yet, right? You know, in the firewall space, you know, I learned this from Stuart Phillips at Cisco in 1998, you know, when he put together the sales pitch, basically, that we sold $1 billion worth of picks with Pixen is the plural, you know, which is basically, your competitors will do this, go forward with the internet and firewalls. And by the way, we're Cisco, so we can save you money that way. And that'll lower their costs to make them more productive and competitive. And if you don't, that's fine, because your costs will be higher, and they will be. And that's where the evolutionary pressures actually drive. I believe duties to protect, you know, like every security person, hopefully out there in the world, at some point has to step back and say, you're not telling me what I need to know. You know, it needs to be built in. The board needs to be involved. It's not just a nod and a wink involved. And a CISO isn't just a nod and a wink, you know, to security. Oh, it's got C in front of the title. No, you have to think this stuff through. And I think in many cases, when you think it through well enough to have good security, you also have more efficiency, higher productivity, you know, better business agility and so forth. And when the ability to get that understanding of yourself as a corporation becomes commonplace, that becomes an evolutionary driver that helps us, you know, security folks, because we need that awareness too.
I don't see many people thinking it through.
Not yet. I
do not see that at the executive level. And it's coming to hurt more and more. And maybe at some point the pain level will get so high that they'll start to adopt thinking, but I somehow doubt it. I think they will do something else.
Right? Well, if the pain actually translates into economics, then the first among a competitive field will figure that out and not have to deal with that. And then that's where our free market, you know, approach to things actually does work quite often.
Over time, evolution takes time.
Yes.
Yeah. And the other thing is it's sequential. So you get these effects where it's like poker, right? The person that wins that first big hand is in a position where it's hard to defeat them.
Oy.
Right. Emotion is behind sales. Logic is behind justification. Next week on the Cyber Show,
Sin goes Google before Google. Peter gets committed to PL1. Wynn disputes a dispute. Ira talks to a loser CISO. And Capital Bank of the U.S. offers everybody millions of dollars. All on next week's Cyber Show.
A good time and bow. A good time and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.